This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's not whether there is systemic racism in this economy, it's what we do about it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 15th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There was an essay posted on the website of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta late this past Friday afternoon, written by the president and CEO of the Atlanta Fed, Rafael Bostic. The title of that essay was "A Moral and Economic Imperative to End Racism." We had, not knowing the essay was coming and by what turns out to be great good fortune, already arranged for Dr. Bostic to be here today. And now, well, there's a whole lot more to talk about. Rafael Bostic, it's good to have you back on the program.
It's great to talk to you again, Kai. It's good to be here.
I don't know if you remember this, but when I was down at the Atlanta Fed last fall, we took a walk through the passageways and the boardroom and all this stuff. And we passed a row of portraits of the past presidents of the Atlanta Fed. And I said something like, "Holy cow, that's a lot of old white guys." And you said, "Yeah, but we're changing that." And clearly we are. But what I want to get to this essay you wrote, and I want to ask about why you felt the need to write it now.
You know, we have been working on issues around inclusion for a long time, but the pandemic and its impacts on the economy really fell hard on lower income folks and people who have not been as well attached to the economy. And that was weighing on us and on me. And then George Floyd's death really changed people's willingness to be talking about these issues. And it just felt like this was a real good time to speak to some things that needed to be spoken to an audience that I thought would be pretty receptive to it and be ready to have that conversation and then the conversations to follow.
It's a pretty personal essay coming from a guy who helps make monetary policy in this country. And you say at the end of this, you say in the last paragraph, "I feel the weight of those affected by the hateful bias and prejudices that have no place in our society." You're a unique messenger, right? You're a black guy running monetary policy in this economy.
Yeah, I'm different. But I think that that's been helpful in this, in the sense that, you know, I live the same experiences that every black male in America does. And when I go down the street, people are going to judge me first by what I look like because they don't know my title. And so I do carry all that stuff. And I think hearing that from me has really caused a lot of folks who have known me for a long time to think differently about what race means in America and their place in it and the things that they might do to help improve the situation.
Well, so let's talk about what things the Fed might do. How much of what is happening, what has been happening in this economy for hundreds of years, honestly, how much of that can the Fed fix? Because as you know, Chair Powell and you, even in this essay, say, look, we have this dual mandate, right? Stable prices, full employment. Tell me how the Fed can do things to change the dynamic now.
Well, I think there are a couple things. One is that what we've learned in the last 10 years or so is that the economy can run a bit hotter than was previously believed without getting inflation to be spiraling out of control. And so what that means is that we can really allow the economy to run and run strong, and that should help all Americans. You know, just before the pandemic, unemployment rates for African Americans were at historic lows. And in part, that was because our policies were not restrictive. We did not put the brakes on nearly as fast as might have otherwise. And then the second thing I think, which is really important, is that, you know, the Fed has the ability to convene. And so we can bring people together and really get them to think hard about what things they might do in their communities to make real change and to lead to the more inclusive economy that I think we should have and that would make America better.
Well, you talk about that. You talk about an inclusive society, meaning an inclusive economy, and that on the face of it makes sense. But so does this, and this is the last thing from this essay, and then we've got other things to talk about. Elsewhere in this essay, you say systemic racism is a yoke that drags on the American economy. And this is going to sound like a naive question, but I'm going to lay myself out there. Why is that so hard for people to understand?
What I think is hard for people to see, really, is that systemic racism is around us all the time. You know, there's a book that I talk about a lot. It's called Citizen by Claudia Rankine. And in that book, she tells a bunch of short stories that describe the slights that African Americans have as citizens in America that most people won't notice. And that's the part that I think that is really different, that for many people, the systemic racism is so ingrained in everything that we do on a basic level that they don't even see it. They don't think about it as a structured inhibitor of African Americans' ability to do the things that other people get to do with no questions. And I think what's changed is that people are seeing things happen that are getting them to think, well, maybe things are different for African Americans. Maybe we should talk about this more and get a deeper understanding. And once that understanding it becomes clear, then that statement is an easy one for everyone to get their head around.
I was reading Isabel Wilkerson's book the other day, The Warmth of Other Suns, and there was a line in it that hit me. One set of people is in a cage, the other set of people doesn't see the bars.
Yes, I was actually talking with another friend of mine, and he said, you know, this is almost as if the scales have come off of people's eyes. So it's not that they were blind, it's that they were structurally unable to see things, and that disability is disappearing.
More now from Rafael Bostic, the president of the Atlanta Fed, in the second half of the program, where he sees this economy going in these changing times. Wall Street on this Monday, interestingly, traders seem to be encouraged by a Fed announcement. We will have the details when we do the numbers. When we all woke up this morning, it was legal in more than half the states in this country for a company to fire somebody for being gay or transgender. And then, in a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court said protections based on sex in the 1964 Civil Rights Act do indeed extend to sexual orientation and gender identity. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more now on what this is going to mean for LGBTQ people who've long suffered economically from employment discrimination.
Workplace discrimination can take many forms: getting fired, not getting hired in the first place, or being paid less or harassed. And those have big implications for the economic well-being of LGBTQ workers, says Lee Badgett, an economist at University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Gay and bisexual men have lower earnings than otherwise similar heterosexual men. And we do see higher rates of poverty for certain parts of the LGBT community.
Those effects are especially acute in states that don't have discrimination laws, says Christy Mallory, a scholar at the UCLA Williams Institute. In Arizona, for instance, LGBTQ adults were twice as likely to report they didn't have enough money for food.
We see that those states in our research are not only states that don't have a supportive landscape, but the social climate is also not as supportive of LGBT people.
A 2017 survey by the Center for American Progress found a culture of discrimination influences workers in less direct ways, too. Many workers take steps to avoid exposing themselves to discrimination in the first place, says policy director Sherita Gruberg.
This could look like choosing where to live, where to work, what they would disclose in employment applications.
Those can all end up depressing workers' earnings in the long run. Transgender people are often the hardest hit, experiencing a much higher unemployment rate. Shannon Minter, an attorney who has represented plaintiffs in discrimination cases, says there's often a direct link between a transgender person's economic and physical security.
When you're economically marginal and you're homeless or semi-homeless, and the only way you can make a living is by doing things that are outside the law, that puts you directly in harm's way.
He says today's ruling will help ensure the discriminatory practices that marginalize people can be addressed through the legal system. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Let's say the government backed more than a half a trillion dollars in loans, a good percentage of which may well be forgiven, to keep this economy from getting even worse than it has. And let's say you wanted to know who got that public money from the Paycheck Protection Program. Both Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and the director of the National Economic Council, Larry Kudlow, say the names of the companies that got that public money should be withheld. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on the transparency desk.
You know who's funding the CARES Act? The Treasury Department, with your money. Yeah, you, the taxpayer. And when the government shells out your hard-earned cash, it usually tells you where it's going. Emma Coleman Jordan teaches law at Georgetown University.
The accountability for who gets it, how much they receive, and whether they're entitled to it, that is a trust factor.
The Trump administration says what we should care about is that the loans comply with the CARES Act. But who got them? The Treasury Secretary told Congress last week it's proprietary information. Mirza Baradaran, a law professor at UC Irvine, thinks there's a couple of other things at play.
Part of this bill is that they left it a lot up to banks, and so it's possible that they just don't know where the funds went.
Also,
it's possible that they do know and they don't want us to know.
We do know where some of the money went. To big names like Shake Shack and Potbelly, who pledged to return the loans. But we only know that because they're publicly traded companies. Aaron Klein is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
PPP was sold to the American public as loans to help small business workers, and they've become grants to pay big business creditors.
Notice he says the word grants, not loans, because businesses don't have to repay them if they fulfill certain requirements like rehiring staff. Klein says that makes transparency crucial.
Failing to disclose who got this money undermines this response and future responses.
And he doesn't just mean future bailouts. He means, like, tomorrow. Because there's still about $130 billion left in the PPP pot. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there will be no photocopying.
Remote internships might have their perks, but first, let's do the numbers. Traders turned things around the day after the Fed said it's going to start buying individual corporate bonds that had been previously announced. But you know how Wall Street loves good news, right? Dow Industrials up 157 today, 0.6%, 25,763 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ advanced 137 points, that is 1.4%. 97 and 26. The S&P 500 found 25 points in the couch cushions, about 0.8%, 3,066 there. Airline stocks pulled back some from steep losses earlier in the trading day. Alaska down 1.8%. United dipped about 1.6%. Delta up just a touch, less than 0.1%. British Petroleum plans to write down as much as $17.5 billion for the current quarter after slashing its long-term outlook for oil and gas prices. Depressed demand amid spiking corona cases is the obvious fear. BP also forecasting a quicker transition away from fossil fuels. Shares there down 1.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast, How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Back we go now to my conversation with Rafael Bostic, the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. At about the halfway point of this very turbulent year to date, we turned to where he thinks this economy might be going.
So my sense is that, the second half of this year is going to be much, much better than what we've seen thus far. I think we're going to see solid growth in the third and fourth quarter. But at the end of the year, we will be behind where we would have been absent the coronavirus. And so there will still be room to improve, to get us back to full recovery. I'm expecting that will happen sometime toward the middle to the end of 2021. But we're going to continue to monitor to make sure that we understand how the economy is evolving as the virus progresses through the economy.
Your colleague on the Fed and an occasional guest on this program, also Rob Kaplan from the Dallas Fed, said this weekend, we're going to need more from fiscal policymakers. That is to say, Congress and the White House, in terms of rescue and relief money. Do you agree?
I think that's probably true. You know, one thing that we're doing right now is we are canvassing the economy broadly to see where relief has gotten and where it's working, and then where relief has not gotten and maybe isn't working as well. And I think that when we identify those places where it's not working, it's important that they get the same support that everybody else has. And I'm committed to going and talking to policymakers, making sure they're aware of places where there does seem to be distress that's continuing as a result of the pandemic. And I'm going to encourage them to think hard about doing things to help those people.
Well, let's break the fourth wall here. We have gotten you in an RV on the side of the road somewhere, I imagine just outside Atlanta or in Georgia somewhere.
Oh, no, we're in Utah.
You're in Utah. Okay. Well, great. You're in Utah.
Yeah.
Even better. What are you expecting to find?
Well, you know, I actually think that what we're going to find is a large mix. And that will be interesting. I actually think relief has gotten through to many more businesses and many more families than is really reflected in the data. And some of the concerns I have are around the timing of the unemployment insurance and how quickly it's getting to families. But the parts that I'm most worried about, and we're going to do a lot of investigation in, is the smallest of the small businesses, that connective tissue in communities that really helps them be close and cohesive, because those are the ones that are the weakest. So I'm really hoping that they're finding support, but I want to really understand the plight that they are going through.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll call you in a month or two after you're done with your road trip, and we'll see what you found. How about that?
That sounds like a deal. I'd be happy to talk with you.
All right. Terrific. Rafael Bostic is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta today in Utah. Dr. Bostic, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai. It's always good to talk with you.
This is, as I'm pretty sure does not need explaining, a difficult time to be finding your way into the working world. Forget hiring into actual entry-level jobs. Even internships aren't all that anymore. The National Association of Colleges and Employers, it's a trade group for college career services people, they did a survey of their members. About 20% of them were canceling their internship programs altogether. Almost half of the rest of them we're moving their programs online, a virtual internship, if you will. And that, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, says something about internships these days.
There is an upside to being a virtual intern.
There will be no photocopying or data entry, actually.
or getting coffee or stapling. That is Maggie Gage, by the way, head of public policy at MetLife. Her department decided to go ahead with their internship program virtually and plan on including their intern in pretty much everything, Zoom meetings, briefings, check-ins.
Given how quickly our teams seem to adjust to living in a virtual world and working from home, and we should probably be able to do the same for our internships.
Still, interning through Zoom is just not quite the same. Nidhi Krishnan is a rising senior at Washington University in St. Louis.
Part of the trouble is that you don't really get as much networking benefits of these internships. So that was definitely one of my apprehensions.
Krishnan's original internship was canceled, but she found not one, but two virtual internships in St. Louis with the ACLU and the Chamber of Commerce. She says they're giving her a lot of work. There are daily check-ins. It's actually working out fine.
They're still providing really good experiences to their interns.
That is in part because for a lot of companies these days, internships mean something very different than they did even a few years ago. Dr. Robert Schindel is president of research and consulting firm InternBridge.
In our studies, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, the number one reason why employers hosted interns was to get work done at a low cost. And now that has completely shifted to identifying future talent.
That's the case for the Real Estate Board of New York, which is still offering a paid internship this summer. Maria Lubman is SVP of HR there.
The biggest goal of this internship from the industry perspective is to have a pipeline, you know, future workforce.
And if internships can be done from halfway across the country now, that pipeline might be getting more inclusive, says Dr. Schindel.
This levels the playing field like crazy. I think it democratizes the internship experience.
Isabella Varney is a rising senior at Emerson. After her internship where she was in Boston was canceled, she got a remote internship with a film production company in Los Angeles.
In a way, it kind of worked out well for me because I wouldn't be able to like go out to LA and afford an apartment and be able to like do an unpaid internship. So it's nice that I can do it from Boston.
But while remote internships can lower physical and sometimes financial barriers for interns, they may throw up others. You need good internet and a decent computer to intern remotely. These issues may persist. Some companies are considering making remote internships a normal part of work life moving forward. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
You got airlines probably right at the top of the list of industries hit hardest by this pandemic. Restaurants are a close second, maybe even tied, now that I think about it. One way those restaurants have tried to get by is by trimming their menus. And even though lots of places are or have already opened up again, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, those menu changes are going to have a long, long tail.
What a restaurant offers on its menu is a simple issue of arithmetic, says Christopher Muller with Boston University's School of Hospitality Administration.
You can't have an extensive menu without a lot of employees. You can't have a lot of employees without a lot of guests or a lot of seats.
But there weren't a lot of guests under stay-at-home orders, so restaurants scale back what they offered. Red Robin recently announced it was dropping more than 50 menu items for good. Mueller says the real losers here will be restaurant suppliers.
For the vast majority of businesses, they have been buying from a handful of distributors.
Companies like U.S. Foods and Sysco, which are like Amazon for the restaurant industry. Mueller says those companies have lost between 75% and 90% of their business this year. Alex Suskind, a professor at Cornell University, says scaling back on menus will take some pressure off restaurants so they can adapt to new social distance guidelines.
It just provides an opportunity for the restaurant operators to kind of reset. And it's hard to do when you're in business day in and day out doing stuff. It's really hard to revisit and rethink things.
Lockdown showed restaurants what people really want, says Amanda Topper, a food industry analyst with Mintel.
Items that are really top sellers that are, you know, low cost to produce. So things like burgers and pizzas and pastas.
Lockdown also let restaurants drop items that only do well in a handful of markets, according to John Quelch with the University of Miami's Business School.
And a proliferation of those specialty local items over time will add complexity to supply chains.
The National Restaurant Association says the restaurant industry lost $120 billion in sales in the last 3 months. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. You know those frequent flyer miles you are not going to be using or actually accruing anytime soon? A couple of big airlines have plans for them. United and American have each said in the past couple of days they are going to use their loyalty programs as collateral for loans to get them through until enough people start flying again. $5 billion worth for United, $4.75 billion for American. How, I hear you ask, are those programs worth so much? Truth is, they're worth way more than that on the company's books. United says its loyalty program is worth $20 billion. Banks and credit card companies buy them, those miles, to use as rewards, hotels, and car rental companies as well. All right, we got to go. Your moment of economic context today is to read that essay by Rafael Bostic. It's right there on the Atlanta Fed's homepage. FRBAtlanta.org is where you go. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.